what I'm doing that in that talk, and we can chat about all that now, you know, it's sort of just us. We don't have to start sitting right on the ball. That is that if you go on a residential meditation retreat of any length from a weekend to a week to 10 days or 2 weeks to 2 or 3 months, you know, like an IMS or Spirit Rock, they're all patterned to some degree or another on the meditation retreat rhythm that the Buddha established in northeastern India, in a part of the subcontinent that was beset, like most of Southeast Asia is, South and Southeast Asia is, but it's really incredible, intense monsoons. When trying to do almost anything outside is pretty much out of the question. And so what they would do when the weather was halfway decent, if really hot, was they'd wander around the countryside and offer teachings here and there. And then when the monsoon set in, they would gather in some place, some well-sheltered place, and they would just hang out together for the period of the monsoon. You know, in India, a period of a few months, right? And they would sit together in retreat. And back then, and in the texts, it's referred to as the rains retreat. And so we've, to some degree or another, inherited and perpetuated that same model here. So we have these intensive residential meditation retreats for varying periods of time, but they're kind of like trying to replicate the idea or the rhythm of a rains retreat. And so what would happen during this period of intensive gathering in and, you know, nonstop walking, sitting, meditation, meals in silence, ennobling silence throughout the retreat, was that it created circumstances favorable for going sort of really deep inside and really what they call peeling the onion, just watching the mind and everything that's in there and all the stuff that's maybe been hiding out in some nook or cranny, and it comes forth and you experience it and remember it. What the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. It's this period of real deep catharsis, reflection and whatnot. And then what happens as a result of that process is that as all this stuff comes forth, you know, from the mind, it also starts to give rise to these insights, these, oh, okay, these kind of connecting the dot experiences where you realize, oh, something that happened back then and how that's affected my view of the world or my behaviors or my thoughts in the present. And so by the end of a retreat, you have a lot of these, you know, a fairly rich trove of these insights into the nature of mind. But then when the retreat ends and you go forth, just like in the time of the Buddha, the way that your mind has been informed by that deep samadhi and that practice and those insights can then help really provide some internal guidance into how you live your life going forward, the decisions you make, how you speak and act and whatnot. And so it feels to me in some ways like we, for almost coming up on a year now, that we have all been on this sort of involuntary rains retreat. That we've had to spend this enforced period of going inward and being solitary and reflecting on, you know, both what we miss, what we grieve the loss of, but also any fresh appreciations that we might have that have come about as a result of this period of, you know, of pulling inward. And then you know, even though we may have just experienced the coldest weekend of 2021, we're not that far away from being able to begin to emerge and to go forth. You know, as the weather warms, as more and more people get vaccinated over the next few weeks and months, it's a time, you know, I'm thinking about what's it going to be like, you know. I think there's a real strong appetite or desire to sort of going back to the way things were, you know, whatever anyone considers to be normal, right? And I think for all of us in Buddha Dharma, we know that's an illusion, you know, that there's no such thing as going back to how things were. It's kind of like a double helix, you know, there's, we go round and round, and there's this similarity to the way things were, but every time the wheel turns, it's a new turning. And so we're getting ready to emerge into a future that in some ways I think is completely unpredictable, just as the last year we spent together was completely unpredictable. Who would have thought that some of the, you know, powerfully positive and constructive things and some of the really horrendous, horrible, destructive things that have happened in our society would have occurred? And yet they did. So it all occurred while we were in this internal state. Now we're getting ready to fall. Anyway, previews of coming attractions. In a mere 35 or 40 minutes, a discussion I'm hoping we can all share in together. Meanwhile, how about we sit? So, maybe for not quite as long as usual, maybe 30, 35 minutes, given how much time I've spent. And then we'll have little breaks, some discussion, talk, and some sharing. So please take just a moment to find your sitting posture. And whether you're sitting on a cushion or a bench on the floor or a chair or a couch, you know, just doing whatever you can to settle in a little more completely into your body, more completely into the moment, centered and relaxed. Arms at your sides with your hands, maybe either folded on your lap or resting on your legs. And then allowing the eyes to gently close. And the attention to come to rest on the breathing, whether you notice it mostly as the air moving in and out your nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. Now expand the field of awareness to take in not only the breathing, but also any bodily sensations or sounds. Or thoughts. Or emotions. Allowing whatever becomes the mind's predominant object of attention to likewise become the object of meditation. So you can watch whatever phenomena presents itself as it arises and changes and passes away, to be followed by the next. And also noting any spaces of calm and clarity that might exist between them. Davis protect you. Sa babula nubavena sa la soti babantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sabha Mangalam Rakantu Sabha Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the Devas protect you. Sabha Dhamma Nubhavena Sada Sotipa Vantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sabha Mangalam Rakantu Sabha Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavam today. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. And may all the Devas protect you. And it goes to the question of dana, you know, the Pali word for generosity, especially as expressed in appreciation for the receipt of teachings. And when we were meeting together every week in person at St. Barnabas Church, you know, our expenses consisted mostly of paying rent to the church. And then also dana for whoever it was that happened to be in the Dharma seat on a given evening. So situation, of course, has changed a little now. We're not paying rent to the St. Barnabas. We are paying rent to Zoom. and we need to be buying a large enough subscription to Zoom, both for our Sunday night sits and also for our other sitting groups or recovery group and other sitting groups. And then also for, we host the Tuesday morning sit that I lead. And so our Zoom subscription expenses have gone up a little around that because of the size and the frequency of our group meetings. And so it's only by means of the dana that you contribute that we are able to meet those expenses, as well as express our appreciation for whoever's in the dharma seat and any of the Insight Meditation Committee of Denver's sponsored sittings. So anything that you find it in your heart to be able to freely give to support these activities, we appreciate. Once we begin to move back toward the possibility of meeting in person at St. Barnabas again, we haven't had a real conversation among the Sangha Council about this yet, but certainly my own preference will be that even once we're able to be meeting in person, I'm hoping we might also be able to find a way to also broadcast our talks on Zoom, so that those of you who, for whatever reason, aren't able to make it to a Sunday night meeting, you know, whether it's the weather or you're not feeling so well or what's transportation, whatever the circumstance, so that you can still be part of our Sunday night gathering, even when we're back in person. So we're going to, yeah, we'll be talking about that and also looking into trying to make sure the church is going to be able to provide us with a feed that's going to allow us to do that. But there's going to probably be some expense involved in that as well. Anyway, that's my own thinking about this, and I'm just off the top of my head right now. But I think it's an intention that we're going to try to work toward if we can. Okay. So there's that. We had last February 9th on my birthday, we had the inaugural meeting of our Queer Sangha support group. And it was really sweet. You know, I had a chance to, you know, meet and get to know each other a little bit. It's an open group. We warmly welcome anyone who feels like it might be a place where they would like to come and be able to be their authentic selves in community. There are a couple of people who are in the group who are parents. And so instead of the 5:30 meeting time, on Tuesday, we looked around for another time slot that might work better for them. And it looks like going forward, we're going to be meeting on Thursday evenings at 7:30 on the second and fourth Thursdays of each month. And I'll be drawing up a new flyer about that, and it's going to get posted on the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado website, and then also we'll be putting it out on our listserv. Okay. So does anyone else have any a knowledge of any upcoming Dharma related activities that they'd like to bring our attention to at this point? No, I know that.
I have a couple.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Okay. Kathleen.
Yeah. And I'll post these to chat too. So David Chernikoff is having an at-home meditation retreat titled Illness as a Spiritual Teacher. And that is happening February 25th through 28th. And I'll put the registration info on the chat. And then also, Barry Gillespie is having an online day-long retreat titled The Happiness of the Buddha, and that will occur on Sunday, March 7th. And then finally, next week, our very own Don Moriarty will be giving the Dharma talk, and the title is Smiling Through the Apocalypse.
Very good. Okay, super. Thanks so much, Kathleen. Okay. So, what I've been doing, you know, just lately, just, you know, as part of my practice, but it also occurred to me something to share with us tonight is, you know, even though this is, you know, especially given the suggestions being rendered to us by the weather, this is very much a kind of an, you know, inside time right now, a period of reflection and introspection. I'm already beginning to think about what are some of the insights or things that I've learned during this past year's period of sort of enforced hibernation, that I might find instructive or informative or useful sort of going forward as we begin to reemerge over the next few weeks and months, as more and more people get vaccinated, and as we begin to be able to be in more real-time, in-person contact with one another. So there are, you know, for me, there are certainly losses that I grieved, you know. Just the lack of personal contact, you know, being able to get together in person with friends and family and loved ones and for coffee or going out hiking or having, you know, a meal together or something like that. So the necessary physical distancing has been a tough one for me, you know? As I'm sure it has been for a lot of us as well. Among the things I've come to have a keener appreciation for are contact with nature. You know, I used to be, I would think about being out in nature as going to run an interpretive program at Bar Lake or going to a state park or a municipal park and where there are trees and birds and stuff. And over the course of this last year, my own kind of sense of that has changed to where now going out into nature feels more like going out the back door into the yard, going out the front door into the street. You know, there are fewer people and there are more birds. I just notice them more, you know. There's this kind of vibrance. The attention is focused more just on what's there, what's around. And I've got a bird feeder, a fairly elaborate one in our backyard now. It has hanging, you know, feeders for the little brown birds, and it has a larger house for the bigger ones, and it has suet cakes for the, you know, for the woodpeckers and whatnot. And it's turned out to be, of course, a big hit. You know, they're ripping through about $40 a month worth of feed out there right now. There are a lot of birds that come around a lot of the time. So, and that, you know, for me, that's very heartwarming. You know, even when the weather's not that inviting, I can still look out the kitchen window and see everybody coming in for a meal and chowing down, having a good time. And they also throw a lot over the side, so the squirrels think that's a pretty good idea. So there's this whole kind of little ecosystem going on back there. I've become much more focused on and kind of linked in with and appreciative of that. And I guess one thing that happened not that long ago that I found a little troubling, but that the Audubon people and others in the know say is actually a good sign, is there is a great big Swainson's hawk that landed on top of the bird feeder and spent a lot of time sort of checking out the situation. And other than that, the entire backyard and the rest of that end of the block was deadly quiet. And so, and of course, you know, this bird was looking to, you know, it's cruising for burgers, looking for a way to feed its young, and, you know, and so they say, well, that's kind of good news, actually, if you have a predator around, because it means that they're drawn to the fact that we're feeding things that are meals for others. And so that has been, for me, personally gratifying. So I'm kind of, you know, I've told my own story here a little bit. I'm really kind of interested in anybody in our group tonight who has what may have been your own experience over the course of the last, what are some of the things that you came to really mourn or feel the loss of during this last year's period? And what things might you have come to gain a keener appreciation for? I'd be interested to know if anyone, you know, has similar experiences or others that they, you know, might want to share with us a little bit. So what did you find it hard to part with? And what did you find gratifying or appreciative about this last year?
I am used to seeing my family about four times a year, and we have not been able to do that. But we have set up a weekly Sunday Zoom meeting, and I think we are all very appreciative of that, and that would have never happened unless all of this started. So, pros and cons, yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks, Kathleen. Please. Others. What have you missed and what have you discovered and appreciated?
One of the expected things for us is that COVID-19 meant that so many things are being done by Zoom, so that the men's group that I thought I was going to be leaving every Monday morning is right there. It's actually more accessible because I don't have to get up and go to the meeting. And everyone is attending far more regularly than was true before COVID-19. So that's been a real blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Thanks. Anything else? Anybody? Mary?
Well, I would just like to say there's just been, of course, so much change and the whole experience of this last year. I lost my housing and my job, and yet I've never been feeling such peace and wellness, and a lot of that is because of the increased opportunity to be in this larger Sangha. And, you know, thank you for welcoming me into the Denver group. And I've just so enjoyed the morning meditations and just seeing everybody's faces. And it has just been a really beautiful year of deepening my practice. And not feeling alone, feeling like there's so much love around me. So thank you.
Oh, Mary, that warms my heart, and I really find myself resonating with what you just said. I mean, in the before times, if you wanted to do any kind of meaningful, deep, you know, especially residential retreat practice, there was a lot involved. You know, in terms of trying to get into a retreat that you would like to attend with, you know, teachers that may be in a lot of demand, all the travel plans and the expense of it and whatnot. And so one of the things that I, just like, you know, what you just told us, for me and for my wife, Abby, is this been this cornucopia of Dharma offerings. You know, whether it's been online retreats or online courses, there's among the teachers I've been really learning a lot from and being enriched by Bhante Anhalayo. His retreats were booked months in advance. You know, I was getting into them, but it was still this incredible, you know, it was like Hunger Games, this kind of weird, bad vibe around trying to receive Dharma teachings from people that you knew could nourish you. And now all of a sudden, bingo, you know, it's there. You know, it reminds me in an interesting way of the Tibetan diaspora. So it was in 1959 when the Chinese overran Tibet, and you know, just conquered it in quite a brutal way, and the, you know, this is a history that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, but in order to really conquer the nation in a way the Chinese wanted to, they had to obliterate Tibetan Buddhism. And they set about doing it in a very cruel and methodical way. There were a lot of assassinations of monastics and physical destruction of temples and whatnot throughout the country. And the Dalai Lama and Trungpa Rinpoche and some other teachers like that, they had to flee the country for their lives, right? And the Dalai Lama, of course, set up a kind of a Vajrayana seat in exile in northeastern India. But something that happened as a result of that, of the Chinese invasion and conquests and destruction of much of Tibet, was that the Vajrayana teachings, Tibetan Buddhism, kind of got forced in large part out of Tibet and into the rest of the world. And so there are now, and it's, you know, beginning in the 1960s and 70s, there really, it's really rich Tibetan Buddhist teachings that were just moving outward in all directions from Tibet and northeastern India. And so suddenly there was all this Dharma that had been closely held. A lot of it was very esoteric and had been, you know, closely held in among the Tibetan monastics, is now being made available in the West. And so suddenly it was like this real opening, this real sharing in a way that had never really occurred before. And so a little bit like that, it seems to me that one of the things that's happened over the course of this last year is that there's this flowing forth of these teachings. You know, these teachers, you know, they're sponsoring courses through the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies or Spirit Rock Meditation Center or Insight Meditation Society in Berry. This real wealth and variety of opportunities from all kinds of teachers that didn't exist before, both retreat practice and also kind of more scholastic offerings. But yeah, there's just really been this outpouring, this wealth of opportunity that didn't exist before. And I can only, you know, given that I know some of the people that are administering some of these programs, I know that that online effort is not going away. It's going to continue, just as the in-person, you know, opportunities begin to come back again. But I think that there's been so much discovered about the value of online offerings that's going to be pretty much a permanent fixture going forward. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Other things to share?
Yeah, my experience has been kind of surprising. I feel like I've been relatively unaffected, even though things have changed. You know, the face-to-face classes I used to teach are now online.
Okay.
And I'm not doing the, you know, meeting people for lunch, at least not nearly as much. But it feels like things are going in the right direction, oddly. I feel like I'm being moved into a cocoon where I'm supposed to be. And I'm not quite sure why yet, but it...
Uh-huh.
Trying to go with the flow, but it really isn't, it hasn't been a disturbing change, even though it empirically things have changed, it doesn't feel like one.
Right.
Out yet. My practice has deepened, not hugely. But moving in the right direction.
The experience you shared, Laura, is, you know, I've heard it from others as well. And it was, I think it was quite a long time ago, back when I was in the Bay Area, that we're starting to do Ram Dass and some others of us who are really beginning to try to figure out ways to share meditation practice in unusual settings. You know, it was when the first efforts began to be made for teaching meditation in prisons. And you know, there was a group, well, I wasn't part of it, but there was a group that that a spiritual teacher that I knew was a leader in of teaching meditation at to the inmates of San Quentin. And they had a sitting group, but mostly what the inmates were saying is that, you know, once I began to do this practice and I began to come to an appreciation of an opportunity for solitude and just sitting and finding a peaceful place in my own mind. So some folks who began to really do that in earnest found that there were some aspects of incarceration that were actually beneficial. Prisons tend to be kind of noisy places, and there's, you know, lights going on when you don't want them to and stuff, but there are also these times when it's quiet and the lights go down, and there is something about the lack of distraction, the lack of being able to go out and go to the movies or, you know, go to a brothel or get hammered or something, that all of a sudden they realize that the conditions were favorable for doing practice. And like Bo Lozoff, the guy that wrote We're All Doing Time, you know, is an ex-con who started up all these wonderful meditation programs in prisons up and down the East Coast. He wrote had this whole thing about how to turn your cell into an ashram. You know, set up a puja table and, you know, work out a practice schedule and all that kind of thing. And there were a lot of guys that, well, I only knew about the work in the men's prisons, but people who really got a practice going and got a strong practice going and stuck with it and took it with them when they left, by virtue of having been incarcerated. Right. So there are aspects about what we all been going through that in some ways are, you know, like Murray was saying, they're turned out to be kind of conducive to going a little deeper on. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, one of the things that, oh, please, Laura, talk to us.
So one I guess sort of negative thing is that I lost my part-time job teaching, although I've been going back and subbing some, but that was kind of a loss of a lot of people, you know, in my life.
Yeah.
Students and teachers and stuff. But on the other hand, you know, I like to draw and do watercolors and a lot. So I've been doing a lot of that, and I go to the Botanic Gardens quite often because I'm
good.
And so that's a wonderful place to sit and meditate and draw. And that's been just, you know, really, nature is always my favorite way to have a, you know, a real spiritual part of my life, being out in nature and observing nature. So I've really spent a lot of time doing that, although not in the last few days, obviously. Yeah. But so that, you know, I think it's been good for me.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I like the reminder that you just offered about opening to what is, you know, and especially in terms of natural settings, when somehow, in some ways, I mean, it's wonderful to be in rich, continuous social contact, but then there's also something about the solitude and about just going out and seeing what there is and appreciating what there is. And the tendency that I think, certainly in the way that the contagion that we're facing right now is constructed in the news media, you know, with this horrible experience, like, you know, some kind of outer space invasion and whatnot, this viral contagion is a naturally occurring phenomenon, you know, and it was brought on. I mean, and people, I used to, you know, direct this graduate program at the University of Colorado in disaster management, and among, you know, it was a good fit for professional catastrophizers like myself. You know, it's like, you imagine every possible horrible thing that could go on, you know, that could happen, and then you plan for it. You know? And so among the things that's been on the radar for people that, you know, that do disaster management, emergency management, planning for it, zoonotic pandemics have been on the radar for a very long time. You know, going back to Ebola and SARS, SARS-1, SARS-2, you know, and these are viruses and other pathogens that reside in animal species in the wild. And the more human contact that occurs with these wild animal species that did not previously occur, the more their habitats are invaded and destroyed, and the more contact there is, the greater becomes the possibility of exposure to some of the pathogens that they carry that can mutate to the point where they can become a threat to human beings as well. One of the things that's going on right now in terms of research on zoonotic mutations and contagions that can jump into the human species and the means by which that happens, there's a really increased interest in the study of bats. And the reason for that is that bats have these extraordinary immune systems, you know, that they can carry around with them pathogens that would completely kill off whole species of other animals if they became infected with them, and yet they don't take out the bats because they have such powerful immune systems. It's good news for the bats. It's not such great news for us, because it means they can become pretty effective vectors for all these nasty things that are floating around out there in nature, that if human beings keep penetrating those wilderness environments and keep increasing the level of contact between humans and those animals, it just makes us that much more vulnerable to the very kinds of zoonotic contagions that we're facing right now. So the people that study these things are saying, you know, just like Ebola, just like SARS, these are going to, in the future, probably occur on a fairly regular basis. You know, there are things we can do to try to cut back on the incidents, like, you know, trying to draw back a little bit and give these habitats some space, not invade them and destroy them to such the, to the, you know, the same degree, but that they are in fact a part of nature. And finding a way to understand and respect the nature of that, you know, that that mechanism is going to be pretty important insofar as, you know, making less likely the kinds of future contagions that are inevitably going to occur, but they don't need to be as devastating and as deadly as this one. But it's part of nature too. It's part of who we are and how we're interacting with the rest of the world. Yeah. It's not different. It's not out there. Part of us. Yeah. So you know, we've been talking about the internal so far, for the most part, you know, our own thoughts and feelings and the losses and the appreciations and whatnot we've experienced personally during this period. I also think about bringing the Dharma forth into a world that is just facing some profound challenges, you know, the society of which we're a part. Just like when we're on retreat and we have things that come up for us, you know, perhaps traumatic events that happened a long time ago that we've chosen to put away in some compartment, that suddenly, like Pandora's box, you know, the stuff starts leaking out around the edges and it bubbles to the surface, and it is there asking to be seen and asking to be understood and perhaps even re-experienced. And then we work with that stuff when we're on retreat and the samadhi is deep and we develop a personal relationship with it. We incorporate it into our healing processes, into becoming more whole and forgiving and compassionate individuals going forth in terms of how we relate to ourselves and to other people. And when I think about some of the really powerful, painful, horrendous events that have occurred in our society over the course of the last year, you know, and right up through, you know, November and beyond, you know, for me, it's a little bit like at the societal level, us seeing us having brought before our eyes the work that is yet to be done. You know, the extent to which, just like when we look deep in our own minds and we see the power of the kalesis, you know, of attachment, aversion, and delusion, and how they've cost us really, you know, maybe some pretty serious problems personally in the past, and we are working to kind of detoxify those forces as we love our lives going forward. I'm really feeling much the same kind of challenge as we go forth in the coming weeks and months, as we're able to be more engaged in the broader society of looking at, you know, are there ways, to me, it doesn't feel, I know I'm starting off from my own, you know, thoughts here, but I really want to do that only as a way to encourage more discussion. But my feeling is that going forth, I don't want to just go back to living life the way it was before. it seems to me like there is just too much that needs to be done going forth, you know, as insofar as, you know, the practice of Buddha Dharma at the individual level, at the personal level, is by one of recognizing the forces of greed, hate, and delusion when they arise in our own minds, and vie for controlling our speech and our actions, and disempowering that tendency and replacing it with an intention of acting out of wisdom, generosity, and kindness. And so I reflect a lot now on going forward, what are ways to a greater extent than I have in the past that I wish to try to manifest that wisdom, that kindness, that generosity in the way that I interact with the larger world. One example is the conversation that we had at the organizational meeting of the Queer Sangha Support Group. And we talked about, I've spoken here in our group and also the setting on Tuesday morning about Sangha of Birds. You know, I even thought about calling it the Queer Bird Sangha. You know, what are the three reasons why birds flock together? One is to help each other out insofar as finding nourishment. The second is for mutual protection. And the third is to make more birds. So in translating that into some of the things we'd like to do in the Queer Sangha Support Group, gathering together for mutual support and spiritual nourishment, just to acknowledge each other's presence and express appreciation for each other's presence and spiritual nourishment. Secondly, mutual protection, being there for each other. You know, and this is something that we do as sanghas more broadly here as well, you know. Being here for each other, witnessing each other's, you know, what Zorba called the full catastrophe. Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Simply being together in community, witnessing each other's dharma, each other's truth, including the difficulties as well as, the aspirations. And then insofar as, you know, the future is concerned, with regard to the queer community, among those most at risk and experiencing the greatest threat are the young. You know, Colorado has one of the highest teen suicide rates in the country and some of the lowest per capita spending on mental health for teens. The suicide rate among queer teens is even higher, right? So back in the before times, our service committee and our Sangha is doing things like clothing drives, you know, gathering clothes and toiletries and other necessities to donate to the teen homeless shelter here in Denver. And these kids that were just really at risk anyway, and the queer teens and even greater risk than that. And so this third aspect of the Queer Sangha Support Group, we are looking specifically after having, you know, woven Sangha together amongst us, how can we put that Sangha to use? How can we help it to serve the needs of others, right? And so, when I think about us, our broader Sangha here at IMCD, you know, that maybe that's also worthy of thinking about, you know, are there ways that we as a Sangha, as well as individually, can perhaps turn some of that energy that and those insights that we may have gathered during the period of hibernation? Are there ways we might be able to share that energy in a focused way that helps make the community that we live in a better place to live. Now, I'm struck, among other things, for instance, by this, you know, among the things that the contagion has manifested is the absolute radical inequalities that plague our society in terms of the rates of infection, the rates of death. You know, the people who, turns out maybe hedge fund managers are not quite really as necessary to our well-being as the people who sack in your groceries. Or the one who's trying to teach the kids, you know, whether it's in person or online. The people, you know, the bus drivers, the people that deliver packages to your doorstep, you know, these folks who are not well paid, they're not well compensated, they don't, by and large, have very good benefit packages, and yet our society depends upon them crucially, you know. Are there ways that we can turn this sense of, you know, generosity, kindness, appreciation, to helping out those who most need it in ways that we didn't even recognize in the before times? So, I don't know. Anyone have any thoughts? Anything they'd like to share around that? Yeah. Karen? You see your hand up?
Yeah, hi. So, I really agree with the your last point about seeing with new eyes our whole society in terms of equality, equality of opportunity, and so on. And to go a little bit before that on something you touched on is sort of what does it take to go into post-COVID, we'll say, with new eyes, with really, mm-hmm. what does it take to have or develop an ability to really change, respond differently? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the calaces and the grip that they have on them. And of course, delusion does as well. And that was tied in with wisdom that you were saying. But I wanted to recommend a movie that Ken and I saw last night, not really knowing much about it, but it's going to be a part of a little discussion group here. So, okay, we tuned into it. It's available on Amazon and Prime and, you know, widely available. And it's called The Sound of Metal. And it is about a drummer in a heavy metal group, musical group. And he starts experiencing deafness.
Oh.
And it's a really lovely and thoughtful and thought-provoking treatment of his process through that and his early eagerness to hang on to the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Hollywood movie. No, it's more of an indie movie. It's, you know, not everything is tied up all neatly in the conclusion.
Yeah.
But I would recommend that. It just feels like it's very fitting for the times. And the actor is also getting a lot of attention. His name is Riz Ahmed. He's outstanding. The whole thing is simple and low budget and outstanding. So the sound of metal, right? Yeah.
Yeah. If you would be so kind, maybe you could write that up as a note and post it in the chat column.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, appreciate that.
Thanks.
Okay. Other sharings.
Yeah,
Okay. Well, yeah. What I've said so far is what's really on my mind to share tonight. If there's no more that wants to be shared, then I think we can go ahead and close our time together. So I'll invite everyone to please find your sitting posture once more. And allow the eyes to gently close. The attention to come to rest on the breathing. Going forth from this moment, from this night, into the future, into what the next day holds in store, the week, the month, the spring and the summer and the fall, and moving back into the greater society. May we go forth with ease and in peace. May we know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May all the devas protect us. When the mind is calm and clear, may we experience the joy of letting go. May we trust in living our own truth. May we be happy. May we be at peace. And may we be liberated. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free. May all beings grow in wisdom. May all beings open their hearts. May all beings know kindness and be kind. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free. Good night, everybody. Have a good week. Bye, Kundarma.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Good to see everyone.
You too, Barbara.
Hey, Lloyd, what would you like to call your talk?
Insight and Emergence.